This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because this is where we gather this time of day. It's our virtual Main Street right across North Dakota. Those real ones are out there that we cross and say hello to everybody and, you know, share our news and opinions, talk about what's on our mind. And today, we have Caroline McGuire with us. She's with United Blood Services, and we're going to talk about a shortage occasionally that comes with the season. It is summer. People are out doing things and occasionally getting injured or maybe scheduling a surgery. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
What kind of organization is United Blood Services?
So United Blood Services is the regional community blood provider. We are the sole provider of blood products to nearly 70 hospitals in the region. Our territory, our stomping grounds, are technically composed of five fixed sites, two in South Dakota, Aberdeen and Mitchell. And then three in North Dakota, Fargo, Bismarck, and Minot. And then all the mobile blood drives in between.
And what is its structure? How you funded? How you kept whole?
We are a nonprofit. We are an arm of Blood Systems Incorporated. So they are the primary blood provider for the western half of the United States, I would say. So we are just an arm of BSI, and we spread, our North Division spreads all across the United States from about central Minnesota all the way over to Spokane, Washington.
So does the Fargo office serve a certain area, or is the blood virtually intermingled however you need it or wherever you need it?
So out of the Fargo area, those five sites that I listed and all the mobiles in between, that's all based out of the Fargo site.
How many people do you employ?
Upon each level of this kind of hierarchy we're talking about, it, we've got about 50 to 60 people at the Fargo site and then a number of different staff members across at our other five fixed sites as well.
Well, when you see things growing, like Sanford Medical Center is going about to open up a very large hospital facility, does United Blood Services have to expand too?
That's a great question. We do expect to partner, hopefully, with the large Sanford Hospital. We hope to start blood drives there. We're not quite sure what it's going to look like as far as the needs, but we do anticipate working with them on that.
If I get a blood transfusion, how much does the blood cost?
That would depend on insurance rates and everything. I'm not sure how much it would cost at the consumer level. Our job is just to make sure that, those blood products are there and on the shelves for them. I believe it would be up to the discretion of the hospital and the insurance agency to decide that.
Well, let's talk about the supply-demand issue here. What are there seasons of need for blood transfusions?
Absolutely. Right now is a major need season, summertime. So everybody goes out on vacations. They We get a lot of our blood products from high schools and colleges, and those are not in session right now. So we do see a decrease in donor because of these issues. However, the need for blood might go up a little bit because people are scheduling surgeries. They have a little bit more free time on their hands. So you see the need rise. So with that kind of opposite effect, we need to work harder to find those blood products within the community.
So you have anticipated a shortage, or you've got a seasonal issue here. How do you accommodate that? What are you doing to get more blood?
We have issued an urgent call for donors. If we do not get a good response within the next few days, we may see a blood shortage. So we are asking people nationwide to take about an hour out of their day to give a donation of blood.
That doesn't take much time, I take it.
It does not. About 45 minutes. We say an hour because sometimes there's a little bit of a wait. However, you should be in and out in about an hour. The actual needle is in your arm if you're giving a donation of whole blood for about 5 to 8 minutes. So it's a very simple, painless procedure, and our staff will take great care of you.
We better deal with that in a little more detail because you did mention the word needle. So you've got good phlebotomists?
We do, yes. All of our staff is trained on the job, of course, prior to them going out and drawing from donors. So they undergo extensive training on all of that, and they will take excellent care of you.
How about a brief educational moment here about the various blood types?
Absolutely. So blood types will range. There are eight of them. We have O negative, O positive. We have A negative and A positive. We have B negative and B positive, and then AB positive and AB negative. So each of those have differing characteristics, things like that. The universal blood donor is the O negative blood type. And so that type can, their red blood cells can be transfused into any other blood type. Any person with a different blood type. So they're what we call, we say that they have gold in their veins because they donate blood to help everybody else and themselves because they can only receive the O negative blood type. So their blood is the blood that emergency responders take to accident sites in case they need to do an on-site transfusion because everybody can take it.
And is that a very common blood type? I mean, that's mine.
It is not. So it is about 6% of the population that has O negative blood. And you probably will know if you're O negative because if you've ever given blood and you're O negative, we will call you because you are so, so important.
How about negative positive? What does that mean?
That the negative and positive is indicated by what we call the Rh factor on your blood cells. It's basically another element on the micro level of your blood that dictates how that works.
Now, blood is red or dark red or almost purple, depending on whether it's a vein or an artery. But what are the components of blood?
Absolutely. So blood is the liquid tissue in your body, fueled, of course, by the circulatory system pumped through by your heart. Veins, arteries, capillaries are the channels where your blood passes through. There are four components of your blood. We have white blood cells. That's what keeps you healthy. So that's the immune system part of your blood. We want you to keep that. However, the three other types we do collect in a donation of whole blood. So there are your red blood cells. Those carry the oxygen throughout your body. Red cells are used for accident victims and surgery patients to treat them. Red cells have a shelf life of about 42 days under refrigeration. Third type is plasma. That is the liquid part of your blood. Flash frozen, that can be kept for about a year, and that is used for burn victims and shock patients. Finally, we have platelets. That's the sticky part of your blood that helps your blood clot when you get a cut. Platelets have the lowest shelf life, about 5 days. Three of those days are used for testing. So we really have a 2-day window where we can get platelets out to cancer patients because platelets are primarily used during cancer treatment.
Well, are you in competition with those companies out there that are getting people to donate plasma?
That's a great question. The FDA, we are regulated by the FDA. All blood collection is regulated by the Federal Drug Administration. So they set the rules. Only blood that is voluntarily given can be transfused into a person. So donors who are compensated monetarily for their donation, unfortunately, those blood products will never be transfused into a person. However, they can be used in other ways like medical research, pharmaceutical development. But that's what makes our work at United Blood Services so, so important. Although we can't compensate you monetarily for your donation, we can say thank you in other ways. Donor incentives like reward points that you can accrue, which are redeemable for things like movie tickets and gift cards, things like that.
Well, I have a friend who's been giving blood for decades now. I think he's in the multi-gallon range, and it's an act of altruism as well. I mean, you pay it forward in a sense.
Absolutely. As much as we want everybody to just want to give blood because it's the right thing to do, we want to keep the blood on the shelves because it's the shelf blood that's going to save a life. We know that people would like to be appreciated. So we do go above and beyond for our donors. We have a monthly giveaway for our donors. Like this summer, we're giving away a Harley Davidson motorcycle.
Wow.
Valued at $8,800. We partnered with Harley of Fargo to provide this excellent gift. Midnight Blue, great starter bike. So if you donate blood with us this summer, your name will be entered to win.
How often can people donate blood?
Depends on the blood donation. Most donors will typically give a donation of whole blood. With that whole blood in our lab, we can separate that blood into those three different blood products, plasma, platelets, and red cells. And those donors are eligible to give every 56 days. So if we stuck the needle in your arm, it was in there for 5 to 8 minutes, and we said you're good to go, you're probably eligible in 8 weeks from that time. If you gave a donation of red cells, double red cells is what we call it, what that means is those really sought after blood types like O negative, O positive, who can help a lot of people. Basically, you can save more lives with one needle stick. We will hook you up to a machine and return the blood products that we don't want to keep. We'll keep your red cells, but we'll give you back your plasma and platelets and take more red cells so that we can help more people with that one donation. So with a double unit of red cell donation, you're eligible every 112 days. So I believe 16 weeks.
You can find out more information at unitedbloodservices.org, or you can go to bloodhero.com as well to, I guess, look into the ways you can contribute your blood to this cause. Is it a matter of people walking up to your shop, or should they make an appointment?
We ask everyone to make an appointment. However, that is definitely not needed. You can certainly walk in at our center located on South University, 3231 11th Street South in Fargo, or any of our other fixed site across the state, as well as any blood drives. Walk into those as well. We will figure out if it's your first time donating, we'll find out what type you are, and then we'll let you know the best donation of how we can use those products and what you can offer for our patients.
I went up on the website, unitedbloodservices.org, and saw a calendar up there. Save Our Summer Community Blood Drive is underway, and you're going to be collecting it at West Acres in the Fargo area here. So that's just a walk-up kind of thing?
It is, yes. This is one of our larger blood drives in the Fargo-Moorhead community, our biggest blood drive, formerly known as the Battle of the Badges.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah. It's been rebranded as Save Our Summer because that's what you're doing for us. You are really saving our summer. We are in a critical need for blood donations. And so come out to West Acres. Right now, we are drawing donors until 7 p.m. Again, tomorrow, 11 to 7 p.m. in the food court, and then Friday, 9 to 3:30 p.m. You do not need to make an appointment. However, it is a walk-in blood drive, so there might be a little bit of a wait. That's what happens when everybody doesn't schedule appointments. But if you go online and schedule an appointment with us and you come at your appointment, we'll get you in at that time.
You mentioned that the blood can be kept, depending on the component, for X amount of time. When you were dealing with the ebb and flow of the need, and you're talking about the summer being a time when sometimes the supply doesn't quite meet the demand, how far ahead do you plan? I mean, how much do you have on the shelves in case of a real community emergency?
Absolutely. We have enough on our shelves to meet the needs. Basically, so I'm a donor recruitment representative here in Fargo, and what we do on our front end is to make sure that we have enough blood products scheduled to come in to make sure we can meet the needs of hospital commitments. When we don't have that, our job is to go out and make sure that we can find it. Recruiting blood donors, scheduling last-minute blood drives, whatever it takes to make sure that those blood products are on the shelves for those donors, because it just takes one unit. Maybe a donor, maybe a patient needs 10 units of blood and they only have a match for 9 units. That one unit will be the difference between life or death for that patient. So it's very important that we are working ahead and making sure that we have coverage for those blood shortages.
You mentioned bloodhero.com, that's the website, but this Blood Hero idea, expand on that for our listeners who might be interested in donating and are, you know, intrigued by that statement, Blood Hero.
Yeah, so we call all of our donors heroes, and our tagline is sort of find the hero in you. We want everybody to feel like a hero, because what you're doing when you take an hour out of your day or 2 hours, depending on the donation you're giving, you are saving a life. We have this really neat feature where you can actually register your cell phone number after you give, and we will send you a text message that tells you when your donation was used to save a local patient. So it really hits home.
Wow.
And you know that it has gone to save somebody's life. So that's where the hero in you comes in. And continue to be a hero. Schedule your next blood drive appointment at the end of your initial appointment. Come back every time you're eligible.
So if I go to give red blood And I'm giving how much? A pint at a time? And is there a recovery period from that? I mean, what does it cost me to give that physically?
Absolutely. So, couple of fun facts. So you have 10 to 12 pints of blood in your body as a grown adult. We will only take 1 pint of that in a donation of whole blood. So it takes about 8 weeks for your body to regenerate that amount of red cells. Plasma is a little quicker. Platelets are quicker. But the red cells are the important part with any whole blood donation. I mentioned that the needle in a whole blood donation is in your arm for 5 to 8 minutes. We're taking that pint of blood. You actually lose 750 calories.
It's a weight loss program.
Right. In 8 minutes, though. So we do ask our donors to have a 15-minute refreshment period after their donation so our staff can keep an eye on them, make sure that they're feeling ready to go back to work and go about their day. Most of our donors have feel better after they donate, actually. It's really if you take the right measures, you're eating a good meal beforehand, you're drinking a lot of water the day of, you should feel completely fine after your donation.
What interested you in this particular enterprise? How did you get involved?
Absolutely. I've been working with volunteers for the extent of my career. I graduated from college in 2013, and I, you know, used to work at the Great Plains Food Bank, actually, and worked with their volunteers there. Fell in love with the idea of this selfless service concept where, you know, not everybody has money, but almost everybody has time. And I can guarantee everybody has blood. So that's why what I'm devoting my life to is encouraging people to give what they have for free.
And I assume that you give.
I do. I would be donating today at the Save Our Summer Blood Drive or this week, but I'm not eligible because I donated at a blood drive 2 weeks ago. So I'll be eligible again pretty soon.
How many people can you handle in a day at one of these blood drives, for example, at West Acres?
We are looking for 200 blood donors every single day.
Wow.
Yesterday, we saw 112 donors. So we're looking to increase that number today. If you have some time, stop into West Acres. We'd love to see you. However, we do need for our entire region with our 5 fixed sites and all the mobiles in between, we need to see 250 blood donors every day. So and that's to meet just to meet the needs of our hospitals. So this big Save Our Summer blood drive is really, really saving our summer this week.
And do you have other blood drives during the rest of the year, or is this the big push time?
We do have other blood drives throughout the year. Most of the blood drives that I'm working with in Fargo-Moorhead would be business blood drives, church blood drives, general civic organization-sponsored blood drives, things like that. This is the biggest community blood drive that we have in Fargo-Moorhead.
So find out about it. You can go online to unitedbloodservices.org or look it up at bloodhero.com. Caroline McGuire, a donor recruit representative for United Blood Services in Fargo, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Main Street, we'll have a story from Harvest Public Media.
Everyone is more than they seem in Capitol Shakespeare's production of As You Like It, July 19th through the 23rd on the state Capitol grounds. In this gender-bending comedy, the banished Rosalind uses disguise to test Orlando's love, and courtiers and peasants revel in the transforming natural world of the forest. Shows of this 10th season production begin at 7 p.m. in the outdoor Prairie Amphitheater near the North Dakota Heritage Center.
Join us for more True Stories Told Live. This time, traditional Jewish weddings, studies in the Congo, and confronting hecklers.
A man got up in the middle of my show and actually yelled, "Go back to America!" Because I've been told to go back to so many countries, never to America.
That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The demand for beef, pork, and chicken raised on smaller farms closer to home is growing. And some Midwest farmers are exploring how to graze livestock to meet those demands while still earning a profit. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
Wendy Johnson runs Joya Food Farm on land she rents from her family, which has a conventional corn and soybean operation near Charles City, Iowa. She lifts the corner of a mobile chicken tractor. It's a lightweight plastic frame covered in wire mesh that has corralled her month-old meat chickens for a few days.
before we just let them out in day range, we make sure that they know, understand that this is their home, so that they go back into it.
Starting now, they will be free to forage and peck the surrounding area during the day. The portable coop keeps them safe at night.
I have watched them eat. They really love the tips of the new grass and then the clover flowers, the white clover flowers.
Johnson has other big plans. She'll rotate sheep through a series of small paddocks, and these meat chickens will follow. They'll eat what they please and fertilize with their waste. She plans for pigs to eventually graze on organic crop fields where their rooting will help improve soil health. Many farmers like Johnson are looking for creative ways to keep acres productive while also improving cropland and wildlife habitat. One possible solution, using grazing livestock to enhance the land they roam.
Multi-species open pasture system has a higher level of animal welfare.
That's Will Harris of White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia. He's gone big on this method.
I believe it is more regenerative for the land, and I think it benefits rural economies.
He spoke to Johnson and dozens of other Midwest farmers in Iowa and described how he came to pasture-raise cattle, hogs, sheep, goats, rabbits, and five types of poultry. To reap the benefits, Harris says, a farmer has to be savvy about developing a market for high-end meats. Over 10 years, he had to stomach millions of dollars in loans.
And today, it's cash flow positive and profitable, not obscenely cash flow positive and profitable. We have to watch every penny, but it's working.
This is not how most livestock is raised. Modern farms look for economies of scale. They focus on one animal, developing expertise and investing in infrastructure. That keeps costs low for us at the grocery store, but it can also generate tons of waste and deplete the soil. Here in the Corn Belt, farmers raise massive amounts of corn and soybeans to feed these big livestock operations. In many areas, the prairie has been gone for decades. But grazing animals is possible, says Adam Janke, an extension wildlife specialist at Iowa State University. He says conservation grazing is a real thing.
And these are these neat examples where people are using the behavior of domestic livestock to mimic, for example, what elk would have eaten or what bison would have eaten, or even to do totally novel things like control invasive species.
Cattle, sheep, and goats all can play a part. But Janke says when, where, and for how long the animals graze needs to be carefully controlled. Moving animals through a series of paddocks, as Wendy Johnson does, is called rotational grazing.
Rotational grazing systems are really productive for wildlife because there's a combination of rest, recovery, and grazing.
Janke says that can allow for a variety of native plants to grow back, which in turn attracts birds and pollinators and helps restore the area to something resembling the former tallgrass prairie. Johnson may never restore prairie, and she can't let her hogs roam freely as they do in Will Harris's Georgia woodland. But his example gives her hope that she can care for her livestock, restore soil health, attract wildlife, and turn a profit. It's not just a dream. It can be a business plan.
And that he is doing well, it just tells me that we have a future and we have a place in agriculture today.
And that's what she was looking for when she returned to Iowa after many years away. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's food and farm issues. Coming up on Main Street, artist Molly Douthat got her start at UND. She's since enjoyed an award-winning career that has taken her to Boston and Ireland. Now her work is on display at the North Dakota Museum of Art. We'll have her interview, and the solar energy industry has had a good decade, but a pretty bad year. We'll have that story from Inside Energy's Dan Boyce. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota colleges will be getting a little less money from Minnesota under the tuition reciprocity agreement. That story from Prairie Public's Dave Thompson.
The agreement allows a Minnesota student to enroll in a North Dakota college at a tuition rate of 112% of what an undergraduate North Dakota student pays in tuition. For graduate students, it would be 127%. But because there are more Minnesota students attending North Dakota colleges than vice versa, the state of Minnesota makes a supplemental payment to help pay for the educational costs for Minnesota students. University System Chief Financial Officer Tammy Dolan says Minnesota sends about 10,600 students to North Dakota schools, but the number of North Dakota students attending Minnesota schools has been dropping. That means...
For the 2015 academic year, the calculated amount is $11.6 million.
However, Dolan says the new reciprocity agreement will cap that amount because of Minnesota's higher education appropriation.
They have an appropriation of $11,018,000 for fiscal year 18 and for fiscal year 19. So a total of just over $22 million for the upcoming biennium.
That would mean a shortfall of about $1.3 million. Dolan told the Board of Higher Education, this means the North Dakota schools will have to pick up that lost revenue.
The North Dakota institutions receiving the Minnesota students would either need to absorb that difference, or they could increase the tuition surcharge to offset that difference.
But any increase in a tuition surcharge will not happen in this academic year because the board has already set tuition rates. UND and NDSU already have big percentages of their student bodies from Minnesota. Board Chairman Don Morton says there is real value to having Minnesota students cross the river.
We just don't turn out enough STEM students, so it allows us to have the engineering classes that we have.
And Morton says there's another positive to having the number of Minnesota students.
Tourism is a big industry in the state of North Dakota. College students, they're tourists that come and stay for the winter. There's a tremendous impact beyond tuition that they have on the economy, and it's all positive.
The board unanimously approved the new reciprocity agreement, and board members say they will look at the tuition issue next year to see if there may need to be some adjustment. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
And North Dakota officials are looking for help from surrounding states as the drought expands. More than half the state is now in severe or extreme drought. Some ranchers are selling cattle because of dried up pastures. Charlie Stoltenow of the NDSU Extension Service says offers of assistance are coming in from across the region.
We have organizations that I know personally from Michigan that are saying, look, you helped us out years ago. We want to help out. It's just gratifying to work in an industry, in a way of life that, you know, people help each other out.
State officials have relaxed some of the trucking regulations to expedite hay shipments, and CRP acres have been opened for haying and grazing. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Molly Douthit. She's an artist, and her work is on exhibit at the North Dakota Museum of Art through the end of this month. She joins us from a studio in Grand Forks, her hometown. Thanks for being with us, Molly.
Thanks, Doug.
Well, give us a brief bio of Molly Douthit, besides the fact that you grew up in Grand Forks.
Yeah, so I grew up in Grand Forks, and then I guess my art career, as far as bio is concerned, I moved to Boston. I did a year there, and then I moved home to save some money, and then I decided that I wanted to go to Ireland to do my master's, and so I kind of went to an interesting program there. It was 2 years on the West Coast, just on the edge of the Atlantic, and I was fortunate enough to stay there for 5 years instead of just the two. And I've still got quite a presence there. Yeah, and in that time, I guess, I sort of found my painting voice.
Well, are you living in Ireland now, or are you back home?
I've been back home for the summer, mainly for the show. I go back at the end of the month for about a week because I do have another show there. I'm just in between kind of deciding on where I'm going to be next.
When did you decide you wanted to be an artist?
I don't know if I really had that choice. My mom said that I came home when I was in third grade with a drawing, and she said she knew then. And I remember being really frustrated with that drawing, so I suppose that says something.
Does art sustain your lifestyle now, or do you have something else you do to, you know, pay the bills?
It does sustain my life, but I found that I need, like, outside resources just for inspiration and kind of to keep active. So, for example, this summer I've been working at Tim Shea's in Grand Forks and just working with plants and watering. It's fantastic.
So what's Tim Shea's?
Yeah, it's a garden center.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that sort of gets to the kinds of things you like to paint, isn't it? You like still life, don't you?
Yeah, I like still life. I like things that I haven't really necessarily set up. As far as the show is concerned at the museum, I have kind of odd things, you know, things that I find, like, I guess I can talk about a painting that was called Fennel Mishap, and it's a painting of basically a jar of fennel seeds fell on top of an egg, and then the egg didn't crack, or didn't shatter, it didn't spill, but it cracked. And then I saw it the next morning, and I thought, well, that's interesting. So then I decided to make a painting of it.
So what did that still life experience tell Molly?
It was, you know, I think of my paintings as little tiny diaries. Like, it's something to remember, and I'm such a visual person that now I get to remember that egg forever and eat it, too.
So how would you describe your style of painting?
I would say sometimes it's comic tragedy, you know, because it's kind of unfortunate when you drop a jar of fennel. But it's sort of funny, too, and trying to make lightheartedness of that. And I've really gotten into color recently. And, being able to kind of find, like, these really bright colors and sort of express myself that way. So that brings sort of a more of a lightheartedness to my paintings.
What artists do you consider inspirational to your work?
Van Gogh is kind of huge influence, major influence. And then there's a lot of sort of turn-of-the-century female painters. One is Gwen John, and she grew up in Cardiff, so she's an English painter. And then Giorgio Morandi was a still-life painter. I think he died in 1962. And then more contemporary people, there's a fantastic painter on the East Coast. Her name's Lois Dodd, and she's about in her 80s, late 80s. And she has just got this fantastic way of seeing things and then putting it on a canvas. It's kind of remarkable.
Well, meanwhile, Molly Douthat from the eastern edge of North Dakota has made a name for herself in Ireland. I Googled your name, and the Ireland's public radio system named you among its fresh Irish painters, 10 under 30 to watch.
Yeah, that was pretty exciting. That happened in February.
So how did you get to be so well-known in Ireland?
Well, at the end of my first year of grad school, I entered a competition, the Royal Hibernian Academy. They have a big summer exhibition, so I entered and I was thrilled I got in. And then next thing I know, I got a phone call that I won a painting award there. And it was a fairly significant award, and it really kind of threw me into being able to do this for a living. Mm. And that was pretty awesome.
This exhibit at the North Dakota Museum of Art that runs through July 30th is part of the Art Makers series, which is underwritten by Dr. William Bosick. He's a Fargo radiologist. What is the significance of the Art Makers series?
The point of this series is really for people who are artists who are kind of at this point in their career where, they're ready to really dive deep into what they do. And for me, that was a bit of a struggle too, to kind of figure out, okay, what's my voice in painting? And then to sort of let that subside, that thought, and just paint. And
what do you want people to know who take in your exhibit at the North Dakota Museum of Art?
You know, I think it's really important for any artist just to know that they're enjoying themselves. And I would like to think that anyone who comes to my exhibit can see concentration in my work and enjoyment.
Well, does your work have a narrative-like arc, or are you painting a story, or is there something that you want emotionally from a viewer? What sort of the takeaway you want somebody to have?
Again, it's like it's just a diary of my life, so if they take away, like, I have a series of rabbit paintings of Joey and Ginger, and if they can kind of get a sense of Joey's attitude and my attitude, that I guess that then I'm successful.
Well, I read a story by Pamela Knutson about you in the Grand Forks Herald about a week ago, And in that, you talked about this rabbit, that you would patiently wait for it to exhibit itself, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Joey was an interesting – it's a girl, and Joey was sort of timid, and she didn't want to settle down when I would come over. And then eventually, you know, it's like any dog. If you go over to someone's house and they're kind of yapping and jumping, and then next thing you know, they're sitting down. And I think it was kind of waiting for me to settle and for Joey to settle, and it would take a while, and you bring a few carrots, and eventually you can sit and you can paint.
And Joey would sort of pose for Molly?
A little bit.
Okay. How does your work inform you about yourself?
Huh. I think it tells me, like, the colors that I like. Painting is, I mean, this is so duh, but it's so visual. And so I can put two colors next to each other and take out all the rest of the information about that scene and really concentrate, and it lets me see my world. You know, this summer I've been painting a little bit of my dog. He's fantastic. And, you know, I'm starting to see Ted in a whole new light.
That's your dog?
Yeah.
Well, what can you tell us about Molly Douthat's process to create a painting from, I mean, just give us a typical example of a piece of work you did and how long it took and what the process was like.
Usually it's kind of, okay, I'm going to paint today. I want to paint. I don't know what I'm going to do. And so then I find a spot to sit, and I have an easel that kind of travels. And then I just sit there. And if I'm patient enough, kind of like waiting for Joey, I'll sit there and I'll find something. And so the other day I was sitting in my kitchen and I didn't know what to paint, and I was frustrated, and, you know, I'm getting down on myself about it. And I kind of look and I thought, you know, I haven't been in this space for about a year now, and I remember just loving the color of the kitchen wall up against this white print that my parents have. And then there's kind of a yellow frame on it, but it's this wonderful milky yellow. And I thought, well, that's interesting, and that's working. And then my coffee pot was there, and I just thought, okay, well, there we go. And then I just kind of start painting. And if I let myself kind of fall into the process and allow the mistakes to happen, and then recovering from those mistakes, and slowly the painting just comes together. And then you reach a point where you think, this might not be done, but I'm done. So then you step away and you look at it in a couple days and you decide, does this need anything? Am I happy? Does it go in the trash? Does it stay here? You know, and then the critique process starts. But really I guess that's walking through a painting a little bit.
So you don't have this finished picture in your head that you transform on canvas. This is evolving as you do it.
Absolutely. I think that would be far too boring for me. I need the risk.
How would you describe your self-discipline in regard to creating a painting? Do you have a structure? Do you sit down and say, you know, I have to spend so much time painting every day?
Okay, this is the problem with coming from the Midwest, is that we have this attitude about work.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to work and you do your job and, you know, and that kind of thing. And I have discovered that I'm a pretty diligent worker, and I get grumpy if I'm not working. So I've had to kind of break the pattern of saying I'm painting from 9 to 5, and I just, if I feel that urge, then it's very important that I follow it. So sometimes, you know, the other morning I was going for a run, and I thought, jeepers, look at this moon. It's in the morning. That's fantastic. And I knew that it's very important to me as an individual and to my creative process to pull out that easel and paint when I got home.
I came across your artist statement for the show that's at the North Dakota Museum of Art, and in it you say that reading is an invaluable source of inspiration for me. I gravitate towards writers who use quotidian or ordinary or mundane subjects, and similar to those I choose to paint. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Sure. Yesterday I was just talking with someone about J.D. Salinger, and I just love the way he writes. And often it's just these simple scenes, these very simple narratives. And the next thing you know, he hits you with something that's just fantastic. I mean, he wrote in Franny and Zoe about this bathroom scene, and it takes up so much of that entire book. And the way he just places the word blue, you know exactly what kind of blue he's talking about, but he doesn't need to go in this detailed description. And it's, you know, it's a bathroom, for gosh sakes, but it's a blue bathroom. And I remember there were, like, I think it was a pink carpet and that sort of thing. So I love the sense of just the everyday, my life, and finding interesting things in it.
Well, you mentioned this color blue that you were interested in from J.D. Salinger's book, Franny and Zoe. Let's talk a bit about color, because when you're in front of that canvas, and you said that color has become a very important part of your inspiration, if you will, how much time do you spend, you know, fussing with a color?
Okay, so I would say in 2015, I had this great residency opportunity in Ballinglen Arts Foundation. This is in County Mayo, kind of northern, in the north of Ireland. And I got really frustrated with my process. So I started making color charts. And I said, all right. And then I'm making color charts. And I just made these very methodical color charts. And I really got into it. And that went on for a while. And I remember talking to another painter. And she said, I spent a whole year on color. And I was like, all right, I'm spending a whole year on color. I don't care if anything evolves from this. I'm just going to look at color. And I did. You know, I was painting along the way, but I really kept up with these charts. And this is the thing about my own process, is I'll do something like that that's very kind of analytical, quite, you know, scientific, and I've got everything. But what I did there was I built up a knowledge base for me. So now when I go to paint these scenes, it's my responsibility as a painter to clean my brush and all this. But I can make those colors a bit more on the spot, which is more exciting to me. I've got this fantastic white that I've fallen in love with. And it's amazing. You know, it's just amazing what, like, all that paint is. It's just metal ground up with a bit of oil. And then you get to make any combinations, which is quite frightening and quite wonderful.
Well, I encourage our listeners, if they're in Grand Forks, to take in your exhibit at the North Dakota Museum of Art. Again, it's through July 30th. This is Molly Douthit. She's an artist. You can find out more at mollydouthit.com. That's M-O-L-L-I-E, Molly, and Douthit, D-O-U-T-H-I-T.com. Thank you, Molly, for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Coming up next on Main Street, Inside Energy looks at rooftop solar.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. You're listening, so you must like us, so you probably want to know all the ways you can listen. You can listen on the radio. Traditionally, you can be a modern and load the Prairie Public app on your smartphone or tablet. You can be cosmopolitan and use TuneIn or iHeartRadio, or maybe you want to be a hipster. You can listen to NPR One. However you like to listen, we're glad to have you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. In many parts of the country, solar energy has been having a good run. Estimates put the industry's growth at 1,600% over the last 8 years. That may amount to a great decade of growth, but solar has been having a really bad year, especially residential rooftop solar. There's been a big-time slowdown in that market, and bankruptcies abound from the likes of Sun Edison, Sungevity, SunIva, and at least one company not starting with Sun, Solar World. Inside Energy's Dan Boyce looks into what's going on.
It's a sunny summer morning in the Table Rock Ridge subdivision. Nestled in a shallow valley in the foothills near Golden, Colorado, resident Nancy Kotz is walking her German Shepherd.
This is Sarah.
One of the things you can't help but notice at Table Rock Ridge is all these stately middle-class houses every single one of them has solar panels.
The houses in this neighborhood came automatically with them. You didn't get a choice.
The subdivision's developer saying, you want a house here? You're getting solar panels. You can buy them or you can lease them, but you're getting them. And Katz is okay with that. She moved here a year ago, and
our energy bills are really cheap compared to California.
And that's one of the core arguments to buying a rooftop solar system, right? This isn't just the green thing to do, customer. It's going to save you money. The power you use from these panels, of course, that's free. And in most states, the extra power you generate, you get to sell that back to the utility. Bang! Except, trouble on the horizon here.
The cost of going solar in Arizona, that is going up.
The Arizona Corporation Commission.
In states from Arizona to Maine, Hawaii, and most recently Indiana, utility commissioners and state legislators are rolling back or reducing the programs that force power companies to pay for the extra solar energy produced by homes. Ashley Brown is executive director of Harvard University's Electricity Policy Group.
How do we build a more efficient energy future? And by heavily subsidizing an inefficient resource, we're not doing that.
One of the big arguments against net metering is utilities have a lot of fixed costs, and every customer who goes solar buys less power. So the utility has to shift those fixed costs to other customers, those who possibly can't afford a solar installation.
Kind of Robin Hood in reverse.
Brown also argues net metering laws were often put in place when solar panels were way more expensive, as an incentive to get people to invest in solar. But costs have fallen dramatically, largely because cheap Chinese panels are flooding the market. Despite this, Bloomberg New Energy Finance predicts a 2% drop in rooftop installations this year. Might not sound like much, but when your industry is used to growing exponentially year over year, it's a big deal. Though solar entrepreneur Jigar Shah downplays this.
Yeah, this is really a temporary blip from 2016 to 2017.
Shah founded solar company Sun Edison. He sold it in 2011. Last year, Sun Edison went bankrupt. He says many of these companies grew really fast and have been spending way too much of their money on marketing. Television spots, billboards, ads plastered in Amtrak trains. That's unsustainable, he says. Solar needs to be sold face-to-face.
This is a big purchase for people. It's $20,000 or $15,000, and they really want to see somebody come to their door and shake their hand and say, you know, trust me, I'm going to put some holes in your roof and put a solar system up there.
Also, there's been a saturation of sorts in California, solar's biggest state. Still, Shah remains bullish and thinks companies will readjust and start growing again next year. And as for states rolling back their net metering policies, he's not too worried because in other states, it's the opposite. For instance, after a big fight, Nevada just reinstated net metering.
More markets are open today than have ever been open before.
Still, Ashley Brown from Harvard University, he's digging in his heels, this time from a climate perspective.
By far, the least cost-effective way of reducing carbon in our environment is rooftop solar.
Way better to go big utility-scale solar projects or wind farms, he says. For Nancy Kotz, though, our solar resident at the Table Rock Ridge subdivision, having panels on her roof just makes her feel good, as long as they're not too obvious.
I wouldn't like it if I walked outside and I saw these big panels in front of my house and it took away from the look.
But hers are on the back of the house. You can't really see them. For Inside Energy, I'm Dan Boyce.
Inside Energy is a reporting collaboration that looks into America's energy issues. Dakota Datebook is next.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 19th. The North Dakota Quilt Project was conceived 31 years ago this month in 1986. It was a means for the Quilters Guild of North Dakota to help celebrate the state centennial in 1989. Leona Tennyson of Antler, North Dakota, was instrumental in the project. Once finished, it would be the world's largest quilt, covering more than a third of an acre.
We want the citizens to take part in doing this, Leona told the Minot Daily News. It's a State of North Dakota quilt project. Each of North Dakota's 1,360 townships were invited to construct a block for the quilt. It was expected to measure more than 70 feet by 100 feet, enough to beat the Guinness World Record held by a Belgium quilt that was just shy of those dimensions. Leona said each township had appointed a chairperson, with Leona the overall director. The piece would ultimately be a map of the state, each county given a designated color. Each township section was marked off in 4-inch squares, and Leona urged quilters to add points of interest, such as churches, schools, railroad tracks, rivers, and agricultural crops. The blocks were stitched together in 1988. When finished in July, the piece weighed 800 pounds and had reached 85 feet by 134 feet, setting the new world record. When interviewed in 1986, Tennyson and her co-quilters expected the quilt to be displayed in Bismarck, but the quilt never found a permanent exhibition site, mainly due to its size. At one point, South Dakota's Corn Palace asked to display the piece, but North Dakotans balked at the idea of sharing it with another state. In 1995, folks from a group called Roadside America made a special trip to see the attraction at Leona's home in Antler. One of the editors wrote the following: "We take a walk out to the garage to see it. The randomly folded, tightly packed mass fills Leona's extended Econoline van to the roof, and Leona is loath to open the van's rear doors, knowing from experience that she may not be able to close them again. But we offer to help repack the quilt and thus are allowed to touch North Dakota's best-kept tourism secret." Leona continued to urge the state to display the textile wonder, but without success. She died in 1995. The quilt remains in the care of the Tennyson family, stored in Leona's garage, but the family has renewed hope that it can still find a home in Bismarck now that the Heritage Center has expanded. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Director Christopher Nolan's latest film is about Allied soldiers rescued by sea in World War II. Some climbed on boats sailed by British civilians across the English Channel.
The idea of any civilian getting on their boat to make that crossing into a war zone, I mean, it's just, it's unthinkably brave.
Dunkirk, and also present-day immigration officers in Texas on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, we'll talk with award-winning songwriter Elisa Karen, who's penned a memoir called 100 Miles to Nowhere, an Unlikely Love Story. Her book is about moving from New York City to rural Minnesota. Chef Tim Rosendahl will join us to discuss salmon, that's cured and smoked salmon, and Ashley Thornburg and I will have our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.